You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Golden Dream by Joe Hagen, with photographs by Tim Davis. Raman isn't eager to talk about crime. She did, after all, call for defunding the police in 2020. She says the homelessness epidemic, nearly 42,000 people live outside in the city of L.A. alone, can make crime feel like an epidemic. A story about crime is more believable when you feel like we don't have a city that's working well, Raman observes. That story falls on more fertile ground. A few months later, in advance of her re-election bid, she will complain of a cop shortage in Los Angeles, a sharp pivot that does not go unnoticed. Raman is focused on the lack of affordable housing, the issue everyone up and down California talks about, but she also points to the fragmented, internecine Los Angeles government in which city council members, lording over bigger constituencies than many members of Congress, defend their economic turf and battle adjoining districts for resources, which makes complex citywide issues hard to manage from the mayor's office. In last year's infamous leaked audio, her Latino colleagues conspired to redraw Raman's district and subvert her reelection. Raman backed Bass, who promised to unite the warring factions. "I really have faith in government," Raman says. "So I think maybe I'm..." "You have faith in government?" says Bowles, incredulous. "I do," she replies. Oh, look, fireworks over Universal. "The housing crisis is caused by the government," insists Bowles, who voted for Caruso. "If this were free market capitalism, there'd be enough housing to meet all the demand that wants housing." Last year, Bowles wrote an essay for The Atlantic entitled "How San Francisco Became a Failed City," which argues that hyper-progressive policies on homelessness and education have helped destroy her hometown. Critics, including the L.A. Times, raked her over the coals for being a debutante rich girl from a vaunted farming dynasty. "I'm not ashamed that my family, many generations ago, did cattle ranching," she says to me. "Two blocks down from where we live," says Weiss, "there's people living in tents in front of people's homes. Should that be legal?" "My answer is no." "There's so many laws," says Raman. "You're not allowed to camp in parks. It's always been true." "They're not enforced," says Bowles. "When you buy a house or rent an apartment, when you move to a place, and you're paying taxes to that place, you're making a deal with the city. You're saying, 'I'm paying taxes to L.A. in exchange for sidewalks that I can walk down.'" Everybody agrees that the apple cranberry crumble is delicious. Raman says the dinner conversation didn't track with what she hears from people in L.A., whom she deems more empathetic to homeless people. "This is the most conservative dinner party that I've ever been to," agrees Barbara the architect. Weiss sighs, "They don't get out a lot." Next photos, real estate developer Rick Caruso, who lost his multi-million dollar mayoral bid last year. A UPS truck after a fire in Malibu. The Orchid Thief author Susan Orlean in her Hollywood Hills home. Jeffrey Katzenberg, Hollywood mogul, producer of Kung Fu Panda, is infuriated that Rick Caruso is still giving tours of Skid Row. "Caruso, you have $5 billion. Why do you keep taking people to Skid Row?" he says to me. "You just pissed away $104 million on a failed campaign. Why don't you put that towards the homeless on Skid Row?" We're at the Polo Lounge inside the Beverly Hills Hotel, corner booth. Elon Musk may have moved to Texas, complaining of COVID lockdowns and taxes, but some of California's super rich want to save California, personally. Trim and bespectacled, Katzenberg opens our conversation by asking me to imagine the year 2028. Mass transit across Los Angeles, the airport transformed by an $11.5 billion capital investment, a new George Lucas Museum, Microsoft billionaire Steve Ballmer's $2 million basketball arena in Inglewood, and the $750 million Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art. And the final piece of the puzzle, the 2028 Olympics. Katzenberg is on the board. With his tidy vision presented, he invites me to tell me how I've got it wrong, because I don't think so. If you've got a problem with California, Katzenberg has a solution. 2 years ago, he drew up 16 pages of what he calls a Marshall Plan to fix homelessness. It wasn't treating homelessness, it was solving homelessness, he says. It became a personal mission. After his car got stuck in traffic under an underpass on Interstate 10 on his way to a Lakers game, I heard a child crying, he says, but crying loud, like hurt crying. And I turned, and in a lean-to tent was a mom cradling a wailing child, maybe 6 years old, going like this. He holds his ear in mock pain. You know, instantly, that's the international sign of earache. It broke my heart that I could be looking at a human being, a child, here in Los Angeles, as I'm about to go sit in a $3,000 seat Laker game, who was probably going to lose their hearing for life, he says. I just went, oh my God. It was one of the most heart-crushing moments of my life, and I could not go home and go to sleep with that. The next morning, he called UCLA Medical School and proposed he fund a street team of med students who would fan out around the city and treat minor medical issues. This gave me the authenticity that I wasn't just some rich guy talking about it, he says, but I actually was funding this with my millions of dollars. Katzenberg traces the city's intractable problems to zoning. Los Angeles, like much of Southern California, was built as a series of suburbs, modeled on the fantasies of Midwesterners and zoned for single-family homes. Affordable housing was rarely built, and home valuations went higher and higher as people elected politicians to defend their valuations, while working-class people were driven to the margins or off the margins altogether. The California Dream started killing the California Dream. Last year, Katzenberg took his Marshall Plan to Bass, then a congresswoman whom he considered a successful coalition builder. He asked her to run for mayor, promising to fund her campaign, and he followed through with $1 million. He took out negative TV ads, blasting Caruso's expensive promise to get 30,000 people off the street, build 100,000 houses, and add 1,500 new police officers and 500 sanitation workers to the city's payroll. And people went, oh, who's going to pay for that stuff? He recounts. Where was he going to get the money to pay for that stuff? Caruso got crucified, Katzenberg says, lost by 10 points. Brittany Nichols doesn't think billionaires should exist. The 35-year-old writer and producer for the ABC sitcom Abbott Elementary believes in wholesale wealth redistribution, the abolition of the police force, and the closure of prisons. She worked for Rahman's campaign 3 years ago and lives with Cerise Castle, who is her girlfriend, in a tiny apartment in Los Feliz with a Chihuahua mix and an albino python. Right now, the left in L.A. is comprised of a combination of people identifying as communist, socialist, and anarchist, says Nichols, who is aligned with Ground Game L.A., a progressive political group associated with three representatives on the 15-member Los Angeles City Council. Over dinner one night at Alltime, a restaurant specializing in California cuisine, fresh, unpretentious, expensive, Nichols tells me rich liberals of the type I've been seeing have grown conservative in recent years to protect their gains against the glaring reality of income inequality. What you see here are people who are presenting themselves as liberal, co-opting the tactics and language of right-wing people, she says. They politicize spaces like schools that they know people have really strong opinions about because they know that's what will scare people. After graduating from Yale in 2011, Nichols moved to L.A. and achieved success in Hollywood. She recently won an NAACP award for one of her scripts, but she doesn't think her success is replicable now because of stagnant wages and unaffordable housing. "The L.A. that I moved to doesn't exist anymore," she says. "I came here to be a television writer, not knowing a lot of people, not making any money, living check to check, and I just don't know how anyone could do that. I don't think that I could move to L.A. now and build a career in television. I don't think it's possible." Nichols subsequently became a prominent voice in the writer's strike. When she got into politics, she discovered a city where leaders align themselves with corporate-funded business improvement districts and allocate taxpayer money to cronies while the poor stay poor, move out of California, or become homeless. A lot of the unhoused are people of color, she notes, and LGBTQ+. People living on the streets, she argues, are the physical manifestation of the greed and corruption that has been happening in this city for decades. "Until entitled Californians cut to the truth of income equality," Nichols says, "the streets should count as a home, which is why she and many progressives insist on the term unhoused over homeless." "There are ways to create a home outside of living in a building with four walls," she explains. "When these encampments and communities that people have created to help protect themselves, when they're at their most vulnerable, are destroyed, that is destroying their home." Before I meet Nancy Pelosi at Pier 23, I take a walk through San Francisco's Tenderloin District, the neighborhood most often held up as Exhibit A of what's wrong with California. For good reason. Hundreds of men and women are living on the sidewalks, passed out in doorways, or huddled in public parks, block after block. Intermingled with the homeless people are men in black jackets with green insignias who identify as members of a nonprofit called Urban Alchemy, a controversial group made up of formerly incarcerated people who act as de facto guardian angels. When a raving man menaces our photographer at UN Plaza near City Hall, one of the jacketed men intervenes. Later, he identifies himself as Leslie Brigham, a former Oakland gang member who spent 33 years in prison for being an accomplice to the murder of a 14-year-old boy. Brigham, who has been homeless before, is paid $21 an hour to spend 5 days a week hanging out in UN Plaza, checking pulses, directing the mentally ill to public services, and shielding local students from overly aggressive panhandlers. The concept behind the group, founded by Lena Miller, a former special assistant to former Mayor Willie Brown, is that people who've been incarcerated have the street smarts and empathy to handle the down and out. I ask Brigham to diagnose the homelessness epidemic, and he blames drugs, but also the police for failing to lock up fentanyl dealers. They want to talk about, on the news, that they're coming down on this fentanyl stuff, and stiffer sentencing and things like that, Brigham says. From what I can see, it's a bunch of crap, because I know guys that just got busted with fentanyl. Within a month, they're out on the streets. The police department has a station around the corner, but Brigham complains that they're just hanging out and getting their paycheck, letting Urban Alchemy do their job. Urban Alchemy has a $39 million contract with San Francisco to manage public toilets and maintain a sense of order around large encampments. Los Angeles recently extended a $2.6 million contract to cover downtown L.A., Hollywood, and Venice Beach. They're part of a trend of California cities employing civilians to manage what used to be the job of local police. In L.A., the city council is considering relieving the LAPD of traffic duties and handing them over to non-deputized citizens. Some community members are disgruntled and feel like the police could do more, says Artie Gilbert, who spent 26 years in prison for murder before becoming Urban Alchemy's Bay Area director. But the police are outspoken, and the mayor done confirmed they on demand. They continuously communicate that to us directly. Urban Alchemy has come under scrutiny from critics, including the progressive Knock LA, who say the group collects millions from cities while overhyping its success, or worse, only adding to the chaos. Members have been accused of sexual harassment, assault, and even attempted murder. Urban Alchemy says it investigates every accusation. A homeless resident in Sausalito claimed she snorted crystal meth with one of the group's street practitioners. "He handed me a rolled-up $20 bill with crushed-up crystal meth," she told a local paper. "After I was done, he let me keep the $20. A world away in the Embarcadero, Pelosi says abolishing the police is ridiculous. She points to the failed attempt in Minneapolis to eliminate the police department after the George Floyd killing. "You don't want that," Pelosi says. "I'm going to call 911 and nobody's going to come? What is that?" Pelosi grew up in a Catholic political family in Maryland that admired and respected the police department. They had a motto in those days, "Always be true to the men in blue," Pelosi says. Now, there were no women at the time, but that was the police motto. And we probably had issues, but didn't realize it as much in terms of the abuses and the rest of that. But you can't decide one against the other. There has to be a recognition, because much of the crime is in the minority areas. Pelosi, for all her rah-rah, worries. Last year, her husband, financier Paul Pelosi, was attacked by a hammer-wielding madman in the Pelosi's living room in Pacific Heights. He'd been looking for the speaker, who'd soon after fork over control of the house to her right-wing antipode from Bakersfield, Kevin McCarthy. Since then, Pelosi's reading of the political landscape has sharpened considerably. "Some people said to me, 'Why are you making a big fuss about safety? Nobody ever brings that up in my district,'" continues Pelosi. "I said, 'Well, good for you. That's wonderful, yeah. But that doesn't mean that it isn't an ongoing problem.' People just don't want people on the street in their neighborhood," she adds. "That's just the way it is." She's sympathetic to homeless people, even advising the unhoused to gather in front of her home to bring political picket signs to skirt vagrancy laws. "If they came in front of my house and were poor, they'd be arrested," she says. I said, "Go get a sign or something." City leaders in L.A. and San Francisco and across California have tried different strategies to house homeless people, from Section 8 vouchers to using empty hotels to constructing tiny house communities and parking lots. Bass vowed to house 4,000 people in her first 100 days, and Rahman had some success putting people in hotels. "We spent a lot of money," California did, "during COVID," Pelosi says, "and it's a decision that everybody has to make, and decisions are hard. So communities will say, 'Well, I don't think they should take away the tents in the middle of the street.' And other people are saying, 'Are they doing them a favor by enabling them to live in tents?'" "But there are a lot of people who don't want to come off the street," she adds, "and that's why I keep coming back to it's drugs and mental health. If we don't get the mentally ill off the street, we're never going to solve the homeless problem." I ask how she would advise fractious California Democrats to find common ground. For Pelosi, it's not dissimilar to the challenge she faced in the far-left squad led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. "There are more ultra-left-wing elements that have come into the scene, and they are to be respected for what they want to do," she says. "But what is your purpose?" "Your purpose is to be great on the social media, raise money there, have a name, identity. That's okay. That's your decision. But if you're going to pass legislation, you have to know what you're doing." Which brings us to Gavin Newsom, caught between the California promise of diversity and tolerance and the chaos of California's biggest cities. Can Newsom build a national profile out of this mess? After an attempted recall last year, for dining in a fancy restaurant during lockdowns and allowing homelessness to metastasize, he's come back emboldened, but he's also covered his flank by allocating more money to housing and pressuring mayors to clean up their cities. Pelosi isn't exactly unbiased on Newsom. Paul Pelosi's brother was married to Newsom's aunt, and Newsom's grandfather worked for Pat Brown, father of Jerry Brown, who attended Catholic school with Paul, the same school Newsom attended. All of our kids, they all grew up together, she says. Yeah, I think he makes a good president, she ventures, though Newsom has told Pelosi he's not interested in running for president. She adds a caveat, whether people encourage him to do so, I don't know. But Pelosi gushes about another presidential prospect in her midst, Adam Schiff, whom she is backing to fill Dianne Feinstein's Senate seat against left-wing progressives Katie Porter of Irvine and Barbara Lee of Oakland. He is fantastic and has a vision, she says. He has knowledge and judgment to be president. In her final act as California's most powerful poll, the speaker would like to be kingmaker. She makes a point of calling Feinstein, whom she has known since the 1970s, a marvel and an icon. Feinstein's fitness for office has seemed uncertain at best for months, but Pelosi's eldest daughter, also named Nancy, has personally helped Feinstein in D.C. so she can make it to the end of the year. As we're departing Pier 23, a man in a Trump golf hat approaches Pelosi, raises his phone to shoot video, and begins barking at her about her husband's tech stock trades and U.S. spending on the Ukraine war at a time when we have homeless people in our own city that can't eat. Nancy, is your son involved with Hunter Biden? He says as restaurant goers yell at him to leave. The moment is not exactly what Pelosi means by public safety, but given what happened to her husband, it's not the opposite either. Her security detail hustles him to the street. They don't have a problem with me, Pelosi says, of her right-wing antagonist. They have a problem with themselves and women. The California of the new era will be greater, richer, more powerful than the California of the past. But will she be still the same California whom her adopted children, gathered from all climes, love better than their own motherlands? From which all who have lived within her bounds are proud to hail, to which all who have known her long to return. She will have more people, but among those people, will there be so large a proportion of full, true men? She will have more wealth, but will it be so evenly distributed? She will have more luxury and refinement and culture, but will she have such general comfort, so little squalor and misery, so little of the grinding, hopeless poverty that chills and cramps the souls of men and converts them into brutes? And that quote is from Henry George, What the Railroads Will Bring Us, 1868. Congressman Ro Khanna found out about the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, which was in his district, on a Thursday night. By the next afternoon, he was on a conference call with 600 freaked-out tech leaders begging for help. Khanna called a Joe Biden advisor and then Janet Yellen at the Treasury Department, and then he rotated through the Sunday political talk shows to apply public pressure on the White House to cover the bank's deposits and stanch a panic. The following Monday, after the administration agreed, Khanna joked that the crisis was turning tech millionaires and billionaires into FDR disciples suddenly. Khanna's district, which stretches from Cupertino to Newark and counts Apple and Intel as constituents, is the richest in California. We've got $10 trillion in market cap, Khanna tells me, over tikka masala at the Nawab's Kitchen in Fremont, a fluorescent-lit hole in the wall of the kind you find in shopping plazas all over the state. Apple has a $5 billion spaceship in my district. California's tech industry is the canary in the coal mine for America's economy. I'm actually very bullish long-term, Khanna says, describing the exponential growth in the tech pipeline, what with AI and cybersecurity and quantum computing. In the near term, however, Interest rate hikes, which hurt companies built on pie-in-the-sky future earnings, have hurt growth companies the most. They're the first to face a slowdown. China also presides over working-class cities to the south, sprawling neighborhoods of immigrants from India, China, and Mexico, who service the lifestyles of the billionaires but can't afford to live anywhere nearby. In Silicon Valley, socioeconomic diversity has evaporated. There's something that just seems out of whack, he says. There is, in Kanna's analysis, a growing tension among California Democrats over the path through this squeeze. On the cost of living, this has been failed policy in California, he says. Immigrants, especially Latinos, who make up nearly 40% of California's population, have become increasingly conservative when facing the fallout from progressive cities like San Francisco. While I was in the Central Valley, 2 hours east, I was told that homeless people from San Francisco were already showing up at the exits off Interstate 5. Santa Clara, which Kanna represents, initially resisted the extension of San Francisco's BART rail system. Who's going to come here? Voters ask him. Kanna votes to the former mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo, as a success story, in part for increasing the police presence. That California is a tolerant place is wonderful, Kanna says, but that doesn't mean that you can go smash into a Walgreens and steal stuff and not have consequences. There's got to be that sense of true freedom, but that's got to be checked with the rootedness that other parts of the country provide. Kanna is critical of Newsom's spending on attack ads last year against Ron DeSantis and Texas Governor Greg Abbott, which spanked them over treatment of trans children and for banning abortion, while California's Democratic candidates faced tight races, losing an uncomfortable number to Republicans. We didn't win more House seats in California because Gavin's numbers were much lower, the margin, than they should have been, he says. Kanna offers a third way, pointing to his work on the CHIPS and Science Act, part of the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act package, which subsidized American chip factories to the tune of $280 billion. In a transparent jab at Newsom, Kanna questions whether California is a proper calling card for national ambitions. I think the message that says Make America California is not a winning message, he says. In November 1993, David Letterman called up a retired Johnny Carson in Los Angeles during his taped broadcast of The Late Show on CBS. Letterman, how are things going there in California? Carson, pretty good, Dave. The mudslides are putting out the fires. During the time I'm in California, the state is pummeled by a drought, torrential rains, floods, mudslides, two earthquakes, and deadly snowstorms, all following fire season. The ground, it seems, is always shifting under the feet of Californians. Disaster is a way of life in California, says Mary Nichols, the grande dame of California environmental policy for the last 45 years. We are absolutely used to being knocked out, and that makes people unhappy and anxious, Nichols says. Sea level's going to rise. The coast is going to crumble. There'll be more floods. There already are more fires. Nichols was in Governor Jerry Brown's first administration in the 1970s and 80s, back when catalytic converters and lead and gasoline were the big issues, and Brown was dating Linda Ronstadt, and again in the 2010s, when Brown returned as a conquering hero to face down a $27 billion deficit. She worked for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to shape and pass the historic Assembly Bill 32 legislation that created a carbon cap and trade policy, and then for Newsom, who signed an executive order to end the sale of gas-powered cars in California by 2035. The campus of the California Air Resources Board, the most powerful environmental agency in the state, is named after her. Californians get used to it, she says, which is itself a challenge. People are more worried about the homeless encampments that they see and whether the lights stay on than they are about climate change overall, even when we have episodes of weird weather, Nichols continues. The government has to be able and willing to continue to persevere, even when that isn't what gets you the daily headlines. She points out that California faces the same urban-rural divides as the rest of the country, making it something of a scale model for national climate policy. It's also a model for political gridlock. Perhaps nothing illustrates that better than the battle over water rights, with farmers in the Central Valley posting signs along Interstate 5 begging the governor to open dams to help irrigate crops for some of America's biggest agricultural farmland, while Southern Californians suck up nearly 15% of the California River, and Las Virgenes Municipal Water District has to issue warnings to Kim Kardashian and Kevin Hart for watering their lawns during a drought. So dire is the situation that the Biden administration faces a Sophie's choice over whether to divert more of the Colorado River to the swing states of Arizona and Nevada or protect the water privileges of squabbling L.A. Democrats. When I ask Nichols for a prognosis for California, she takes a deep breath. Okay, death is inevitable, right? She says. Nobody's figured out a way to prevent people from dying. But we can definitely prolong life and make life less painful. And I think that's what's happening in California. Californians can get a little defensive about their paradise. Rachel Kushner, the novelist and essayist, says Easterners don't understand the ungraspable scope of the giantess of California. I live in a place that is wonderfully unknowable and many different places at once, she says one afternoon, when we're cruising around Echo Park in her mint 1964 Galaxy 500, the gleaming lowrider with white leather interior featured on the cover of her book of essays, The Hard Crowd. So I think that's something that people from New York City kind of miss. They come here and ride around in a car because they're trying to see a bunch of things at once, and they're not getting a feel for what the place really is. But also they feel offended, especially if they come in December and see that the lemons and the tangerines and the grapefruits and the oranges are all ripe, and that there's snow on the San Gabriel Mountains, and everyone has a yard, and they're mad, they're effing mad. But on my sightseeing tour, Kushner also points to the lake where Jack Nicholson rowed a boat with Faye Dunaway in the Oscar-winning classic Chinatown, and which had a chain-link fence around it, after the LAPD cleared a giant encampment in what Kushner describes as a totally egregious, gross, and idiotic, overwhelming display of force. 2 days later, Kushner texts me from San Francisco, where she's giving a reading and visiting her parents, a biotech engineer and a native plant activist. My parents are laughing hysterically that a journalist is asking if life in California is sustainable. They think it's the funniest thing they've ever heard. The stand-up comedian Sheng Wang, a Berkeley grad with long hair, spectacles, and a laid-back hip-hop mien, may have the most sane reaction to modern California. He gets stoned and hangs out with plants. Californians, like their diverse flora, are survivors. In the freaking desert, they're doing it in one of the hardest places to do it, and they are doing it well, observes Wang over dinner one night before a show in Santa Monica. And they look good. They have such different looks, different styles, the desert plants, man. Wang, originally from Houston, moved to L.A. to write for the All-Asian Network TV show Fresh Off the Boat, hired by Ali Wong, the stand-up comic and producer, whom he met in San Francisco in the early 2000s. During the pandemic, when comedy clubs were closed, Wang developed a slideshow of California plants, to which he added narration about the personalities of a fiddle leaf fig or ponytail palm plant. He wanders Huntington Gardens in San Marino, in suburban L.A., like he's at the best party in all the land. Wang's closing bit on his Netflix special, Sweet and Juicy, is about the absurdity of trying to buy a house in L.A. with the financial prospects of a 42-year-old Taiwanese American trying to make it as a stand-up comedian. At minimum, he needs $1 million. They think I'm good for it, he marvels. They think I'm good for $1 million, plus $900,000 in interest. That's $2 million. They expect me to provide them over my lifetime. They know something I don't know. I visited California in the year 2023, a time of great uncertainty and shifting paradigms. The state that once epitomized the spirit of possibility and untamed dreams now stood at the precipice of an ambiguous future. As I walked the streets of Los Angeles and San Francisco, I couldn't help but feel the weight of a collective restlessness, a yearning for answers in a world consumed by chaos. Gone were the days of the carefree California of my youth, where a sense of boundless optimism permeated the air. The Golden State had tarnished, its luster dulled by a relentless barrage of challenges that seemed insurmountable. The dreams that once flourished like wildflowers on the hillsides now withered under the scorching heat of reality. And that was a ChatGPT response to the query, write about the future of California in the style of Joan Didion in Slouching Towards Bethlehem. Oh, please, come on, says Pelosi at Pier 23. California's not dead. Anybody who wants to underestimate the dynamism of California does so at their peril, she says. I think that we're not only great, we're a model to a country. A true freedom state, one might say. Newsom's slogan originated with his attempt to insert himself in the trans debate, positing California as a haven for those suffering under harsh anti-trans laws in places like Florida and Texas. The right has tried to use trans rights as a wedge issue, but California has always proudly been one-stop shopping for wedge issues, whether gay rights or reparations for African Americans. A San Francisco committee recently proposed distributing $5 million to every black citizen of the city in compensation for slavery and redlining. The more California changes, Pelosi says, the more it stays the same. Squabbling among Democrats isn't a weakness, it's a strength. For those who say, well, it's not what it used to be, thank goodness, because we all should be growing, she says. And you have to learn from people. Don't you think that more people are in favor of LGBTQ because they've learned from their family members, the next generation, from younger people to whom the future belongs? Politics can only fix so much. At the dinner party at Susan Orlean's, faces go a little slack when you start talking about local politics. Rashan, the one-time editor-in-chief of Los Angeles Magazine, said the talk of the town that week was the mountain lion that ran loose in the Hollywood Hills, a beloved local legend, before it ate somebody's dog and had to be killed. When Orlean complains about an encampment at the bottom of her hill, Rahman, whom Orlean didn't vote for, perks up and says, I cleared that camp. It's a lonely job. Hope for the future is perhaps California's greatest unquantifiable resource. Kind of tells me the most consequential thing to happen to California that will dwarf probably anything else and which future journalists will be writing about 50 years from now occurred 45 minutes east of San Francisco. The Holy Grail, he says, of replicating the sun. Near the end of my time in California, I drive to Livermore and witness a scene out of an Ursula K. Le Guin novel. A matriarchy of physicists and engineers presiding over a giant laser in pursuit of a new science that could save humanity from itself. Kim Bodil, the director of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, along with her top three lieutenants, all women, reported the first instance of fusion energy late last year, firing 2.05 megajoules of laser heat at a BB-sized target and igniting hydrogen into a helium atom and a neutron, the fusion reaction that creates more energy out of the target than we put in with the laser. We've demonstrated the fundamental building block that says fusion is not impossible, says Boudil, who looks like the love child of Meryl Streep and Carl Sagan. She is in the business of applied physics, but she is also in the business of dreaming outrageous California dreams in what she calls her magnificent palace of science. Within 50 years, fusion, she says, could alter the course of the world, upending geopolitics as we know it, powering grids with clean, non-carbon-producing energy, adaptable the world over, energy equity for all. Unlike wind or solar energy, fusion is a one-size-fits-all solution, she says. It could go anywhere. And as with the climate and the housing and the crime and the tech pipelines of Silicon Valley, all she needs is money. Boudil dreams of financing a laser 50 times more powerful, one that could achieve ignition 10 times a second. With $1 billion a year, she says, a twinkle in her eye, you could have an amazing fast-moving freight train of fusion activity. For now, she resides in present-day California and rattles her tin can like everybody else, waiting for the future to arrive. Boudil, originally from Chicago, does her yoga and her spin classes and roams the high-security campus at Livermore, listening to audiobooks. Her latest, Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. Boudil manages a yearly Oscar pool and typically wins, she says, successfully predicting before it happens that Everything, Everywhere, All at Once will take Best Picture. It's a no-brainer, of course. I mean, where do you get the multiverse and the everything bagel converging, she asks. Only in California. Kelsey Lately, with two Super Bowl rings, a star turn hosting Saturday Night Live, and charisma for miles, Travis Kelsey could wind up in the broadcast booth or on the big screen. By Tom Clute, with photographs by Nick Riley Bentham, styled by Dan May. Opening photo shows Kelsey near a pier with his dog. Travis Kelsey had a week off but work to do. Last fall, the Kansas City Chiefs star made his way to New York to pursue a dream he's had since he was a kid in Ohio. When he stayed up late on weekends with his mom, watching the likes of Chris Farley and Will Ferrell. Hosting Saturday Night Live, Kelsey's manager Aaron Eanes tells me, was the only thing he ever said he wanted to do. He first visited his brother Jason in Philadelphia before deciding to make the pilgrimage to 30 Rock two nights before Halloween when Jack Harlow was guest hosting. My brother always talks about how it's a quick drive from Philly to New York, Kelsey recalls, so I just said, you know what? I'm not doing anything. I'll just get up and go. Kelsey had been circling Saturday Night Live for years. Eanes made inroads with producers in 2021, but after the Chiefs were blown out in the Super Bowl that year against Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the tight end's hosting prospects were put on ice. He had done some scouting of his own and recognized another hurdle. Most of the recent NFL players to serve as host played the game's marquee position. There's only been like maybe three or four guys that weren't quarterbacks that ever got to actually host, Kelsey says. But the ultimate obstacle would be how the Chiefs finished the season. If Kelsey were going to host, he was going to have to be a recently crowned champion. If Aaron Rodgers won the Super Bowl, Lorne Michaels says, I would have been happy to have him. His late October visit didn't hurt his cause. He hung with New York Yankees slugger Aaron Judge that night and spoke into the wee hours with Michaels at the after party. I thought he'd be good, Michaels recalls, and I kind of hoped they'd win the Super Bowl. Weeks after he and the Chiefs won their second title in 4 years, beating Jason's Eagles, Kelsey became one of the rare athletes to host Saturday Night Live, an exclusive group that includes Michael Jordan, Charles Barkley, and Peyton Manning. His performance in March was shockingly good and not merely funny for a jock. Just to ask Mr. Saturday Night Live himself. I think he killed it, Michaels told me. He's a natural. He was a presence from the moment he walked out. The Saturday Night Live gig was the highlight of Kelsey's off-season ascent to the A-list. Maybe you saw him in April tossing out the first pitch at the Cleveland Guardians' home opener with an errant throw that failed to reach the plate. If you were online a few weeks later, you may have seen a clip of him at his music festival, Kelsey Jam, chugging a beer and spiking a replica Lombardi trophy as the speakers blasted, "You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party," the Beastie Boys banger that's become his go-to party anthem. We have all been witnesses to the summer of Kelsey. When I met up with him in Los Angeles back in April, Kelsey was in the midst of a typically jam-packed itinerary. He had just been in Florida filming promotional material for an energy drink with Judge and was gearing up for the opening weekend of Coachella. After that, he was due in Dallas for workouts with Patrick Mahomes and company, and then it was off to Las Vegas to play in Justin Timberlake's celebrity golf tournament. By month's end, he was in Kansas City to make a cameo at the NFL draft and to host his namesake music festival, which featured performances by Machine Gun Kelly and Rick Ross. Given the headlines he's made this offseason, Travis Kelsey douses clubgoers with 6-liter bottle of champagne, wild Vegas party, blared TMZ in February, one might forget that Kelsey is still, first and foremost, a football player. With a pair of Super Bowls and a growing collection of individual records, he has a budding claim to be the best ever at his position. When it's all said and done, I think you're going to have very little argument that he's the greatest tight end to play, says Shannon Sharp, a legendary tight end in his own right. His on-field legacy firmly secured, Kelce, 33, has raised the ceiling for what he could eventually do off it, whether it's in the broadcast booth or even on the big screen. He recently signed with talent powerhouse CAA. Kelce is poised to join the fraternity of athletes who find greener pastures in retirement, but what precisely his next act will be remains to be seen. I don't know if what I want to do has really been done yet, he says. It's a brisk spring morning, and Kelce and I are seated under a tasseled umbrella on a restaurant patio in West Hollywood. He's dressed cozy for the weather, sporting a bright yellow Palm Angels tracksuit with green stripes along the sleeves and pants. There's a gold Rolex on his left wrist and small diamond-encrusted hoops on each ear. His hair is freshly buzzed with a tight fade on the sides, his beard neatly trimmed. And he's crying. Kelce is given to raw emotion, a fount of let's effing go and pro wrestling bravado. After his most recent Super Bowl triumph, he commandeered the post-game interview on Fox, first emitting a primal scream, and then, while jabbing his finger at the camera, calling out anyone who doubted the Chiefs along the way. That night, he embraced his brother Jason at midfield, voice quivering and eyes misty. A month later, while hosting Saturday Night Live, Kelce got choked up at the end of his opening monologue after mentioning that he grew up watching the show with his mom. In this case, we were talking about his trajectory to the NFL and the bumps along the way when I shared a quote from Butch Jones, his coach at the University of Cincinnati. Travis Kelce is why you coach, Jones had told me. I think of him as one of my sons. To be able to sit back and see the success he's having, the Super Bowl, Saturday Night Live, it's like a proud dad moment. Kelce unfurled a white cloth napkin wrapped around unused silverware to dry the accumulating tears. He caught me at a moment in my life when I was down in the dumps. I didn't really think much of myself, he says. He had a turbulent career at Cincinnati, where he arrived as a quarterback, left a tight end, and endured a year-long suspension for smoking pot in between. When I got hit with what I was going through, he said, of this seminal moment, I found out how many people were in my corner. After an undefeated regular season in 2009, Cincinnati was invited to play in the Sugar Bowl, and Kelce hit Bourbon Street hard. I was down in New Orleans, listening to Lil Wayne, and I wanted to smoke what he was smoking, he recalls. But on New Year's Eve, the night before the game, and after days of cutting loose, he and his teammates were summoned for a drug test by the NCAA. I'm just sitting there dead in the water, he recalled. Under NCAA rules at the time, Kelce was dealt a one-year suspension. I just wanted to get out of there, he says. I was so embarrassed. I didn't want to look at anybody. Kelce wrestled with a suddenly uncertain future in lengthy phone calls with his parents. I told him, it's a great learning opportunity. Live with it. Grow from it. Learn from it. It is what it is, and you just have to deal with it now, Ed Kelce said. His dad recalls. All the while, I'm biting my tongue about how stupid it is that they're going to suspend a college kid for smoking pot. Give me an effing break. What Kelce endured could now be categorized as a relic from a more uptight era, before widespread legalization. Under the NFL's marijuana policy, which was adjusted in 2021, players are only tested during a two-week window at the start of training camp in the summer, which he says has made it a cinch to pass. If you just stop in the middle of July, you're fine, he says. A lot of guys stop a week before, and they still pass, because everybody's working out in the heat and sweating their tail off. Nobody's really getting hit for it anymore. He estimates that anywhere from 50% to 80% of players in the NFL use cannabis. But 2010 was a different era. Luckily for Kelce, he had not only his coaches and teammates in his corner, but his brother. Jason Kelce arrived at Cincinnati as a walk-on in 2006 and became an all-conference player who was drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles, where he has established himself as the best center in the NFL. He was entering his senior year when Travis was suspended, which brought out his brotherly instincts. Jason said, "Look, you're living with me. You're going to be in my house. I'm going to know everything you're doing, and that's all there is to it," recalls their mom, Donna Kelsey. For Jason, who shared the house with several other members of the football team, the move was about putting his younger brother around the right people. "I'm a big believer that what you end up doing and becoming comes down to who you surround yourself with," Jason said. "We weren't choir boys in that house. We drank, we had fun, we enjoyed the college experience. But all of the guys in that house were incredibly committed to the team and to being the best football players they could be. Everyone took ownership of Travis because everyone saw the good that he had," says Jones, now the head coach at Arkansas State. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.